Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks so much for joining us. This week, Kevin Nance gets the backstory on the new murder mystery Dead Man Blues from author Silas House. We explore how climate change impacts seasons, and Tree Week is coming up, and we'll have details on that. First, it's now safe to say that many, maybe most of us, are feeling quite uneasy about the atmosphere in our country. Political violence, for example, has been happening more frequently and with lethal results. What's driving it is this week's focus of Eastern Standard contributor Carolyn DuPont and her guest.
So I'm pleased to welcome G. Elliot Morris, a data-driven journalist who writes the Substack Strength in Numbers. Morris formerly worked as a senior data journalist for The Economist and as editorial director of data analytics for ABC News, where he ran 538's data journalism. So thanks for coming on today, Elliot.
Well, thanks so much for having me on here.
So you say that polling data shows that most Americans reject political violence in all circumstances. And then you go on to suggest that there's been some misleading polls around this question. So can you take us through the best data on this question?
Well, yeah. And this is crucial, right? Because it's important first that we understand what our neighbors feel, how they're approaching politics just the way we are, and also that we sort of properly gauge our reaction to the problem here so that we can approach solutions correctly. And I think at the end of the day, that's what we all want, is a solution to some of these problems. And the data on this is quite hard to gather, and that is the real sticker here. So there are, broadly speaking, two ways that pollsters or researchers conducting polling ask Americans how they feel about political violence and whether or not they would support it. And the most common way is to simply ask them straight up. You find your sample of 1,000 people, whether that's on telephone or door knocking or on the internet, and you ask them, hey, would you support violence by a member of your party against another party? Or would you support someone intervening violently in an election procedure to prevent the other party from taking power? Hypotheticals like this, where the real mechanism is, would you support this thing? And lots of people report these numbers as facts. So then the statement that you read in the news, as the listener here, is 30% or so, let's say. I think some numbers go as high as 36% of the public would support violence, political violence. But this number is based on lots of hypotheticals. And it's also based on, and here's where I have to get a little bit nerdy, and I'm sorry.
That's all right.
It's also based on some methodology of how these surveys are conducted. And the reality is that a lot of people that pollsters interview now are very, very likely to just say yes to the questions that they're asked. And many times this does not present problems, but when the thing we are trying to measure is something as bad as partisan murder or just violence in general, you really want to be careful about that yes percentage. So some researchers at an organization out of Dartmouth called the Brightline Watch, they have a fancier technique for interviewing people where they don't just ask you, would you support this thing? First, I'll ask a lot of people questions. Would you support violent felony? Would you support a violent misdemeanor? Would you support murder? Or would you just support, you know, smashing windows? Some people consider that violence. And then they're very careful to filter their survey and to only keep respondents who they know are really engaged in the question. And they find much lower rates of violence. So instead of 36% of people or 28% of people, these are numbers from recent surveys, saying they support partisan violence, these researchers find numbers closer to 4 or 8% for generic violence, and numbers as low as 1%, or just statistically hard to find for, you know, straight up partisan murder, which is in some ways the worst case scenario here.
Well, that is very comforting to hear. So if the actual numbers for support for violence, political violence, is so low, why does it seem to us that it's happening with more frequency and severity?
Well, the problem here, of course, is that even if 1% of people support partisan violence in America, that's still a lot of people.
Yeah.
That's 3 million people, 3.5 million people. That's about 2.5 million adults. So that is unfortunately enough people for there still to be a lot of harm done to our, you know, our fellow citizen, our neighbor, just because of their partisanship. So, and there has been an increase in partisan violence recently, the acts of this violence, even if there has not been a large increase in the share of our neighbors who agree with that violence, or even if there has been a slight increase, it's not as significant as some people would have you believe. So this is just what statisticians would call a base rate problem. There's just so many people out there that even if incidence of violence is very low, that's enough to be a serious problem. Really, any violence at all done politically is a problem.
Mm-hmm. But it's certainly low enough that statements about those people supporting violence are problematic when we're just referring to our political opponents. So you go on to write that high levels of violence are preventable. How are these high levels of violence preventable?
Well, there's a couple of things that we can do as citizens to help here. And the big thing we can do is issue these correctives like you're allowing me to do right now on your airwaves. And that's because some other studies of the American people have found that if, say, you're a Republican or say you're a Democrat, if you are told that members of the opposing party support violence at a high rate, it actually makes you more likely to support partisan violence. There's a sort of let's fight fire with fire dynamic in the American psyche when it comes to partisan violence. And that's not mysterious. In some ways, that is to be expected. We have really intense partisan identities these days. We feel like we're playing on a team of football when there's an election coming around, and we want our side to win. And increasingly, we want our side to win at all costs. And that cost is violence. So in one study, some researchers found if you issue this corrective, if you say, well, actually, it's not 30% of Republicans or 30% of Democrats, it's actually closer to 4 or 1%, depending on what you talk about, people's passions cool and support for violence among that party reduces by about half, by about 50%. And that is an extraordinary decrease. That is meaningfully smaller when what we're talking about is, you know, so high stakes. So that's one thing you can do. Another thing, maybe just get off social media. This is going to be hard for a lot of people to hear.
Yeah.
I have recently deleted all social media apps from my phone. I know a lot of people who are doing this because other surveys find that the types of content that you might encounter in social media is much more politically polarized than real world content, let's say, than your communication with a member of the other party in real life. And this all has to do with the algorithms of these social networks, right? They want your attention. They want you to stay on there. They want you to be mad so that they can make ad dollars against your, you know, your tweet impressions or your Facebook posts. So they show you pictures of the other party that are much more polarized and also a lot angrier. And this conditions our own anger response and also increases potentially, I don't want to get over my skis here on the evidence, but potentially increases proclivity for partisan violence. So yeah, you might just issue this corrective if you hear people talking about this, and you might also disengage from social media platforms to the best of your ability.
So I think kind of what you're saying is on social media, we see the very worst that the other side has to offer, and then we tend to generalize from that to everybody on the other side.
Yeah, that's a very artful way of putting that. Another way, there's a great book I read, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago that really stuck with me. It's called The Social Media Prism by a Yale sociologist, Chris Bale. And that prism lens, no pun intended, is a good way, I think, to look at this problem through. I mean, it's as if you're holding up a piece of glass in front of your eyes. I wear glasses, so I do this all the time, that codes everybody left or right. And when you're on the internet, you just see really, really harsh shades of red and blue everywhere. And you ascribe all the behavior to these people as being indicative of what everybody on that side believes. And when it comes to political violence, this is a particularly dangerous assumption.
Yeah, it's reality distortion in a very concrete sense. We're all living in a distorted reality field when we're spending a lot of time on social media, what I hear you saying.
Yeah, that's the gist of it.
You've kind of already said this, but I think it just bears emphasizing that the very overestimation of willingness of the other side to engage in violence itself increases the number who support violence. So can you just talk some more about that and take us through that a little bit? Because I think that's really the crucial point of your writing.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe we can think of this as happening step by step. So if you imagine two groups of people, let's just say they're both of the same party, social scientists find that if one of these groups of people holds the belief that the other group of people, say 75% of those people in the second group, support political violence, that first group is much, much likelier to support political violence themselves than if they had been told that the other group does not support political violence at a high rate. And this is directly observable in experimental evidence. Social scientists have done this exact experiment where they, you know, they'll have you come to their offices on a campus and complete this questionnaire, and part of the questionnaire tells you these people over here in this, you know, mythical group, 75% of them support political violence. Another way this measurement happens is the pollsters will take samples, real samples of the American people this time, not these hypotheticals, Republicans or Democrats, let's just call them partisans. It doesn't matter what party they're in. And they ask you, what percent of the other party do you think supports partisan violence? And do you yourself support partisan violence? And they find that when people report very high perceived rates of political violence in the other party, they themselves are much likelier to support partisan violence, about 20 or 30 percentage points more likely to support partisan violence themselves.
Wow, that's staggering.
Then if everyone was told, you know, only 5% or something of the public supports partisan violence. So yes, these misperceptions are very dangerous because the way that we feel is so much a product of how we feel other people feel.
Yeah, it reminds me of Arthur Brooks, who says that in almost all conflicts, people overestimate the amount of hate on the other side, which then, of course, it creates a vicious cycle that makes you hate the other side more. And I think it so speaks to the need for people with a platform and for political leaders not to say that their opponents support violence, because that then produces that ongoing effect in people who listen to them.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, after Charlie Kirk's tragic assassination, you had a very responsible, in my opinion, reaction from many members of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Who said, this is bad. You know, mm-hmm. This is not who we are as Americans. And that speech in particular, this is not who we are as Americans, is very influential, very powerful. So much so that in the aftermath of similar acts of partisan violence previously, listeners will remember Donald Trump's attempted assassination, or the attempted assassination against Donald Trump in 2024. After that, support for partisan violence among Republicans fell by about half, for partisan murder and for general violence on behalf of their party. And I expect if there were any social scientists that just happened to be out there with a survey around this, a similar time of Kirk's assassination, they'd see that very same decrease among Democrats because of this language that they were using about how bad this was. That's the type of leadership that the country needs in these crises.
Yeah, I think that that's really where you land in your piece, is the need for leaders to behave responsibly now. And if leaders don't behave responsibly, we've got to behave responsibly in that way. Well, I thank you so much for this very helpful conversation. And I hope that folks will find your Substack, Strength in Numbers. Elliot Morris, thanks so much for being on today.
Well, thanks for letting me come out here and spread my message. I really appreciate it.
Coming up after the break, why it's important to pay attention as a changing climate tinkers with the seasons. Tree Week is coming up and we have details. And Silas House on his new crime novel, Dead Man Blues. I'm Tom Martin. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at weku.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Silas House is out with a new murder mystery, Dead Man Blues, and in a visit with literary contributor Kevin Nance, we hear not only about the story, but also about how keeping Minnie's spinning place in the air all at once propels House's work as a celebrated Kentucky writer.
Welcome back, Silas. I thought we'd start by just talking a little bit about the story of Dead Man Blues. Tell us, give us a little bit of what the premise is, and then I'm going to have a follow-up question to that.
Well, it's set in the 1950s, 1955, in a little bitty town on a lake straddling the Kentucky-Tennessee border. And the main character, Dave Hendricks, is the disgraced former mayor of this little town. He's lost everything, his wife, his best friend, his house, and he's living on a houseboat on a little marina and just sort of starting over, you know, in his late 30s. And suddenly a couple of grisly murders happen in this little town, and he becomes the prime detective in solving the cases. So it's sort of, you know, he's not a cop. He's deputized, but it's a very sense of place based, very character driven, sort of old school mystery.
He was the former sheriff of this town, which is called Shady Grove, and he then became the mayor, and then he found out that his best friend, who was the sheriff, was having an affair with his wife, and that just drove him nuts, and he ran his car into the courthouse, which led to his resignation as mayor, and he's been hanging out. When we meet him, he's a little bit, you know, got his tail between his legs.
He's looking for his purpose, and he finds it in that he's really good at, you know, he has a former case that he's sort of regionally famous for having solved. So he has a knack for solving crimes. Yeah.
The Murders at Fogtown.
That'll be its own book someday.
Well, I thought that when I read the title, The Murders at Fogtown. Yeah. That sounds like the sequel right there. Is it the sequel?
It's not the sequel, but I'll get to it eventually. Yeah.
Well, Dave he's caught up in the story because the sheriff deputizes him. He's really the only guy around that has a whole lot of experience as a murder investigator. You mentioned the two grisly murders, and they are a young man who's works at a fishing camp, and then his father, who is sort of the big wig of the town, who's the state representative. He's very rich. He has a big, fabulous house up on the hill. Yep. And then before you know it, he too turns up dead in the river, in very much the way bodies tend to come up through from lakes and rivers in movies like Carrie and Deliverance.
It's a favorite scene in the book is who discovers him. It's pretty. I enjoyed writing that.
Yeah, there's a terrible moment where a young girl is swimming in the lake and she gets tangled up with this dead body.
It's pretty cinematic.
It's really ghastly. Yeah. Well, also the Night of the Hunter reminded me of that too.
The Night of the Hunter was an influence on this for sure. Yeah.
Well, the location is very important in that this lake is not just any lake. It's a lake that formerly wasn't even there. It's a lake that is the result of the damming of rivers that were coming together in this location by the Army Corps of Engineers a generation earlier. And we learn very early in the book, I'm not revealing anything, I don't think that I shouldn't, that when both of the dead bodies show up, they have messages that refer to the sins of the fathers. So we immediately get the sense that the motive of the murder has something to do with something in the distant past, which is something right out of Raymond Chandler and Ross Macdonald and other novelists. Did you have specific antecedents for this book in terms of who you were thinking of or what kind of approaches to the material you were taking?
Well, that aspect of the book is really mostly inspired by growing up in a lake town and growing up on a lake where people were, you know, we were thankful to have the recreation, the flood control, and the electricity generated by the lake. But there was also something lost in that people had been run off their land, and this beautiful land had been covered by the lake. So, you know, anywhere you have a lake, there's those positives of the recreation, electricity, and flood control. But there's that negative of the loss that so many people from that area feel, you know. And so I was
like, the graves of their ancestors, yes, got covered up by, yeah, the water and all that.
It takes a lot from people. And that's a story that is especially pertinent all over the South, especially where the TVA lakes are. You know, people, it's beautiful for us and wonderful for us now, but we have to remember that people lost their ancestral land for those lakes to exist. And so that's really at the heart of the book.
And in this case, they got cheated out of,
yes,
their lands,
exactly,
they,
right,
by somebody who knew,
yeah,
as they did not, as their parents did not.
Yeah, it's nice to have like an element of corruption in a murder,
yeah,
mystery, you know, and you bring in lots of layers of class and things like that. Yeah.
It's sort of like, you know, it's Chinatown, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
Did you have a lot of fun writing this novel? I mean, you know, I don't know if you've ever thought about this. It's weird when you think about it that people love murder mysteries and they find them relaxing. At that, mm-hmm, often you hear,
yeah,
that in people, we read murder mysteries for enjoyment.
Yes.
But of course, if those events were happening in real life, they wouldn't be remotely entertaining. I mean, it's the most horrible thing. But somehow, reading about murder in a fictional form is just delightful. Why?
Well, I think it's because we know, we have the expectation that we're going to have a solution, that somebody's going to be held accountable. You know, everything is going to be wrapped up. And that's not the case in real life. You know, often there's not justice. Often there's not a sense of satisfaction when you witness injustice and things like that. So in a murder mystery, we have that promise that it's all, you know, it's all going to be revealed and everything will be good at the end. You know, even though, yeah, you have to witness some violence and some bad stuff to get there. But ultimately, the satisfaction is that somebody's going to pay for this.
I think you said one time that you used to read a lot of,
mm-hmm,
murder mysteries, Agatha Christie and others. Did you, was that something that helped you out in the writing of this book?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing that I love about murder mysteries is that there is a formula. Now, having said that, some people think that means if you have a formula for something, that makes it easy. I would argue that it makes it even harder because you know there are certain things you have to do. And the main thing is you cannot leave any stone unturned. You have to make sure all the plot holes are filled. The main way to lose a mystery reader is not to, you know, not to get all the threads tied up properly.
Well, you also, I feel like, have to give your reader sort of a fighting chance.
Mm-hmm, exactly. That's the hard part.
Yeah, because the reader likes to be kind of guessing all along. Well,
yeah,
who is it, you know, and you raise our suspicions about all kinds of characters. And I was thinking, oh, well, this is going to be a femme fatale right,
mm-hmm,
here.
Yep.
But she turns out not to be.
Perhaps
I shouldn't
changes.
Say that.
Well, your opinion changes throughout the book on who it might be, right?
Right.
And the way I wrote this murder mystery was that every suspect I introduce, I wrote a scenario in which they did it. And then I didn't really pick who did it until I got to the end. And I took one of those scenarios, and that was the person. So each one of those five suspects has to have a realistic story that could be.
Yeah. Well, and I think the motive for the murder is tied up with the lake, as we've sort,
mm-hmm,
of talked about. But not just that.
Mm-hmm.
There's personal bad blood,
yeah,
retribution, revenge, and
right,
all of those things that come into it. What did you what made you decide to write a crime novel as opposed to the literary novels that you're known for?
Well, I love writing literary novels. But I also have always loved the mystery form, and I just wanted to see if I could do it. I just thought it would be, I like every book that I do, I want to take on a new challenge. I think it makes you a better writer. And so I want to do that. And I also wanted to write something that was much more escapist, that when the book is over, you can put it aside and that's it. You don't have to really think about it anymore. With literary novel, you're meant to keep thinking about the literary novel and keep exploring. It's not, you know, it's not all tied up. You don't necessarily have a real neat resolutions and things like that, because you want the reader to keep thinking about it. But I wanted to write a piece of escapism. You pick the book up and the whole rest of the world falls away. The book is over and you just wait for the next entry in the series.
Speaking of which, I happen to know that you are in the process of writing more books and stories about Dave Hendricks, with the Dave Hendricks as the detective, yes?
Yeah. Yes.
And in fact, you've already written one?
Well, I'm writing it right now. Yeah, I'm writing the sequel, and it takes place the following spring. And I'm thinking each of them will take place, you know, in consecutive years. And so we'll, hopefully I'll be able to write enough that we can move through the 50s and the 60s.
That's a lot of new.
I have high hopes.
Well, but do you want
to? I'm hoping to live that long, for one thing.
Do you really? But what about your literary? You're not leaving literary fiction behind.
No. No, I am always writing four things at once. I have never, ever since I was 25 years old, I've been working on four projects at once. And I think that makes all four projects better because, you know, when I flag out on one, I move to the next one. I peter out on it, I move to the next one. You know, and so my energy is always up in each one that I'm working on.
I see. You also had a book of poems came out recently.
Yep.
And that turned out to be a bestseller. My gosh, how unexpected was that?
It's most unexpected because books of poetry, you know, rarely make it onto the bestseller list. I mean, some of the lists don't even count poetry. That's how the industry looks down on poetry so badly, because, you know, that they don't even list it sometimes.
Right, right.
And it's historically because, well, you know, there's the famous line, the songwriter leaves my brain right now, but he said, "Ain't no money in poetry. That's what sets the poet free."
Yeah. One more thing about Dead Man Blues, and it's suggested by the title, is that there's a lot of music in this book. Dave it seems to be a fan of old time jazz and blues. There's references to I think Bessie Smith and all kinds of people that are, you know, well known, and so he has eclectic musical taste. He also listens to Ernest Tubb and
Hank Williams
and all these people. I think you have this, you have a practice of creating a sort of playlist. Is that right?
That's one of the things that sustains me when I'm writing a novel is I have a song assigned to each character that helps me get into that character. I have a song for a particular scene. When I'm writing a scene, it will have its own song that I'm listening to. And that way, if I'm working on that scene for a week, every time I sit down, you know, I can listen to that song and it takes me back. It's just a technique that I've developed that works for me. And all writers have to find, you know, those ceremonies that work for them.
Last thing, you have written this novel under a pen name, a loose pen name, S.D. House. Why is that?
Well, I wrote it under a pen name of Jasper Walker, named for my two grandfathers, and they wanted me to use my real name. I couldn't use my real name because of contractual obligations, so it's sort of boring contractual stuff. However, I also love having the pen name because it does separate it in a way and lets people know this is something a little different. I mean, I'm not sacrificing language or characterization or sense of place. But there are places in the book where I probably would have spent more time on description, but I also know that, okay, we got to keep this moving. We're getting near the end. People want this action. So on one hand, I'm not sacrificing any of that. But on the other hand, it's a genre book. So I'm focused more on keeping you entertained than anything else.
All right. Well, congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you reading it.
Kevin Nance in conversation with Silas House on his new murder mystery, Dead Man Blues, just recently released by Penguin Random House. We can learn a lot about climate change by paying attention to the seasons. The science is called phenology. It's the focus of research at the University of Kentucky, conducted by Liang Liang. I asked Dr. Liang to help us better understand connections between climate change and seasons and how we can have a role in this ongoing research. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. My pleasure.
So we'll have more a little bit later in our conversation about how a listener can get involved in the USA National Phenology Network's Citizen Scientist Program, and we'll get into those details in a little bit. First, if you could tell us more about what you do.
Sure. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Kentucky. My research focuses on the geographic patterns in plant phenology. Phenology may not be a discipline that is well known by many people. So according to the Greek word root, phenology studies the things that are showing up or appearing. So it focuses on the timing of things appearing, the things invisible becoming visible. For example, after a winter season, you see the new leaves coming out from the seemingly dead branches, right? And in the fall, the golden colors of leaves are uncovered by the degradation of chlorophyll. So all these phenomena are called phenophases or phenological events that we investigate. And the timing of these phenological events are really triggered by both the environmental changes and also the internal environmental requirements of plants as well as other organisms. So the focus of phenology is really the timing, like when do these events occur in relation to the seasonal environmental changes. But the seasonality along with phenology also changes from place to place. So people living in different parts of the planet have varied experiences of seasons. As a geographer, I'm particularly interested in exploring how do phenological timing variations occur over space, and what are the environmental and the genetic drivers of these spatial changes, and how can we predict these changes under climate change.
In this work, have you noticed any significant alterations in the four seasons here in Kentucky?
Yes. So Kentucky is a very unique place. According to the EPA's data published, we haven't seen as much temperature increase in Kentucky compared to other parts of the country. Specifically, Kentucky has warmed 0.6 degrees Fahrenheit over the past 1.25 centuries. So that's only 1/3 of the temperature increase across a contiguous U.S. But this temperature increase has mostly occurred in the winter season and the spring season. So the winter season defined by from December to February and spring from March to May. In Kentucky, the temperature increase in winter actually is comparable to the national level, close to 1.9 degrees Fahrenheit compared to the 2 degrees Fahrenheit increase across the country. And spring temperature increased a half of a national level, like 1 degree Fahrenheit compared to the 2 degrees Fahrenheit across the country. And interestingly, summer temperature actually has become 1/4 degree cooler. Well, the national average increase is 1.6 degree.
What's going on in Kentucky that makes it so different?
Okay, this is a very good question. So this actually is not just Kentucky. It's a pattern seen in the southeast of the United States. Huh. So while the western part, northern part of the country experiencing dramatic temperature increase, the southeast of the U.S. has experienced much less temperature increase. Some places even getting slightly cooler, according to the long-term trend. So studies have been showing that this might be attributed to a combination of factors, including the regrowth of forest, air pollution, and the intrusion of Arctic air due to the meandering jet stream patterns, bringing cold air down to this region. That's why that we are seeing a somewhat unusual pattern here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, around Kentucky.
Well, we know that plants and animals may adjust the timing of certain seasonal events like
tree flowering, migration in the case of birds, based on changes in the weather. And I know that your focus is geography, but I'm wondering if in your research you've noticed any significant adjustments linked to a changing climate.
Yes, so my research is more at a continental scale using remote sensing. I do use a few observations as well, but in general, there are a lot of studies showing a pronounced trend of advancing spring events and delaying fall events. So that can be summarized in a statement, spring forward and fall back. For instance, the peak bloom dates of cherry trees in Washington, D.C. Has advanced by 8 days since 1921. But this simplified spring forward and fall back pattern cannot be applied to every species and every location because the environmental drivers of phenology is quite complex. For instance, people may think a warmer weather is going to advance spring events, but for many woody species, in addition to a warm temperature in the spring, they also require a period of a cool temperature called chilling to bring the plants out of dormancy. So the warmer temperature really has a double-edged sword effect. It could either promote growth if the dormancy is released, or if the dormancy is not released, and this warmer temperature may actually delay the fulfillment of chilling requirement. So in that case, some species may actually show the opposite trend of shift. This is something that really varies from place to place and from species to species.
Pulling us out of the natural world in terms of the forest and so forth and into agriculture, how do these shifts affect food security or food production?
We know that agriculture follows the seasons. Because of the every year we have a season of growth, so we can have food being produced by crops every year. So it's very important for the seasons to be operating in a normal fashion so the crops and also the fruit trees can follow along well. Especially using fruit trees as example, the fruit trees are very sensitive to the temperatures in both the winter and the spring season because the fruit trees would require a period of dormancy, which is triggered by gradual cooling of temperature in the fall. And when the winter gets warmer, the fruit trees may not receive enough cold temperature to reach a sufficient level of cold hardness. And that will expose the fruit trees to cold injuries. And on the other hand, with warmer spring season, some trees, after the dormancy being released, may be tricked into premature bud breaking. And when that occurs, before the last frost has passed, those tender buds are going to be damaged by the frost. And this phenomenon is called a false spring. So this occurred actually in 2012, when we had a very warm spring, and causing almost 1 month earlier of the flowering, and those early flowering were damaged by the frost afterwards. So that actually triggered a $500 million loss to the fruit growers in Michigan alone. This year, there are also reports from Virginia fruit growers seeing the fruit trees being affected by the similar spring weather events episodes.
Do these changes in seasonal cycles have any implications for human health?
Definitely. So there is a significant health impact by the changing phenology in relation to the allergy seasons. So the tree pollens are probably less affected because of the intricate environmental drivers of tree phenology. We may not see like increased allergy seasons, but for the grass pollens, definitely there is a trend of increasing allergies caused by the grass pollens because grass species are more opportunistic and they can flourish in any favorable temperature and moisture conditions. So with the increase in temperature, the season contributed by the grass pollens are going to be prolonged.
So I guess the fundamental question that I'm asking here, are the seasons being impacted by climate change?
Yes. So if I understand your use of term season, by also including the biological aspect of phenology, mm-hmm. definitely that we are seeing a lot of changes happening. And we are trying to find a long-term trend because we need to distinguish between the interannual variations and long-term trend. To confirm a long-term trend, we need to have a long-term data. Just by having a few years' experience cannot really see that we have seen a trend.
How much time do you need to feel confident about it?
We would prefer to have multi-decadal time frame to confirm a long-term trend.
So it'll be quite some time before we know for sure whether or not this has occurred.
Yes. So that really requires on a patient the data collection year after year and careful tracking of the events happening so we can have a more confidence about the trend.
I think this emphasizes the critical nature of science like which you're carrying out, which we know is being threatened these days by funding cuts. And you're giving us an example of science that takes a long time to accomplish and to get to a conclusion. Are you concerned about these disruptions?
Yeah, I realize this pursuit might be affected by the general conditions of the society. So we know that in order to track the changes in the nature, we will need to have a dedication to collect the data carefully. And especially because of phenology is considered to be a early warning sign of more fundamental ecological changes.
Canary in the coal mine.
Yes, it's a kind of gentle form of a canary in the coal mine.
Uh-huh.
Because the phenological changes are plastic, they adjust with temperature variations across years. But there is also a threshold. So with the phenological change, there is going to be consequence to other aspects of the ecology as well. So if we take this early warning sign seriously, we would be able to make proactive efforts to prevent more serious problems.
Tell us more about the Citizen Scientist Program and how listeners can get involved.
Yes, sure. We have a national program called USA National Phenology Network, and they have a citizen science program called Nature's Notebook, which coordinates the efforts from anybody who is interested in the nature and contributing to this effort of phenological data collection. So you can do this very easily by looking at plants in your backyard. Here in Lexington, you can contribute to observations in the arboretum. So it's very easy and also enjoyable thing to do. Well, you can contribute to a meaningful effort of tracking the changes in the seasons in relation to climate change impact. You could also participate in local phenology programs. In Kentucky, many people have contributed data, but there are two local phenology programs. One is led by myself. I mainly use this program to involve students in my class to participate in phenological observation, so they will not only be educated about important aspect of the environment, but also they will contribute to a meaningful effort to collect scientific data. And the other group is led by my colleague, Jess Slade, who is a native plant curator at the Arboretum State Botanical Garden of Kentucky, where you can also participate. By doing these such observations, you're really helping us to track the seasonal changes to create a baseline. So what's the current state, and also help us to track the changes happening in the future.
How can a person sign up, get involved?
Oh, it's very easy. You can go to the website, usanpn.org. You can just also Google Nature's Notebook. Actually, there is a phone app available you can download from either Android or iPhone App Store. And the name is just Nature's Notebook.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm going to get one of those.
Okay, great.
That's Dr. Liang Liang. His work at the University of Kentucky concentrates on bioclimatology and plant phenology, and we've been talking about the impact of climate change on the seasons. Thank you so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Dr. Liang says you can get in touch with him via email, liang.liang, and that's L-I-A-N-G, at uky.edu, and there's a link to his webpage on our site, esweku.org. With us now is Lynn Roach Phillips, co-director of the Urban Forest Initiative, Tree Week, happening through October 19th. Welcome, Lynn.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And so first, tell us what's happening during Tree Week 25.
Tree Week is a celebration of trees and all the ways that they affect our lives. And this year, as you said, Tree Week is October 10th through the 19th, and it's happening all across Kentucky. It's largely a volunteer-organized series of events and arranged through interested persons who lead activities that elevate our appreciation for and understanding of trees in society. So how we do this is we put out a call for volunteers from each community to lead events. These could be teachers, librarians, park managers, nature lovers, or any member of the general public who values trees. And some of the activities that we have coming up are community tree plantings, mulching events, guided tree walks and hikes, educational activities, arts, yoga under the trees, poetry readings under the trees, musical performances under the trees, trivia contests, and other miscellaneous activities that target school-age kids and their families.
Well, that's a lot. And it's really expanded over the years, hasn't it? How many other communities in Kentucky will be hosting a Tree Week?
Thanks for asking. We have more than 20 counties across Kentucky that are being represented this year, from Benton in Marshall County all the way over to Hazard in Perry County and Cowan Community Center in Letcher County. Right around Lexington, we've got Georgetown will be doing things, activities at Berea College, Richmond, EKU is hosting things. There'll be an event at the Buckley Wildlife Sanctuary in Frankfort and the Life Adventure Center in Versailles. So reach out, get involved in Tree Week.
You know, I think most human beings are tree huggers at heart, and we just seem to have this affinity for trees. Let's explore that for a second. What do you think's going on there?
Yeah, I think it's always good to remind people of the role of trees in nature and in our cities in particular. We hold Tree Week during the time of peak fall foliage in Kentucky, when trees play a special role in our landscape. And we want to take that time to honor the beauty, the ecological contributions, and the roles that trees play in our personal and community health and well-being. We believe that trees are foundational to our urban and community landscapes for climate resiliency, for our personal health and well-being, for our mental health, for aesthetics, for reducing our overall electric bills, for all the ecological benefits that trees provide. And we want to see as many trees in our cities as we can fit.
Lynn, I recently learned about microforests, and I may be way behind on this trend, but it kind of blew my mind. And I understand that there is one in Louisville. What can you tell us about microforests?
Yeah, there is. And there's currently a microforest that's just recently opened up in Louisville. It is associated with the University of Louisville's campus. So microforests are teeny tiny, dense forest patches positioned in places where forests had not existed before. And the microforest in Louisville is at the University of Louisville's Christina Lee Brown Environ Institute at Founders Square, which is at 5th and Muhammad Ali Boulevard. But the idea is that you plant trees very, very densely in, healthy soils. You need to get the soil, get the site right. Plant them at the density that are 20 to 30 times higher than what we would find in nature. And the plants respond by competing against each other, so they grow faster. And when they grow faster, they grow their capacity to absorb more carbon and deliver those ecosystem services that trees are known for. There's also another one. It's in Frankfort. It's at the Dolly Graham Park on the waterfront in South Frankfort, and it's called Fantasy Forest. It was planted in 2010, and what I know about it is it contains medicinal plants as well as various trees, and along with those trees, beneficial insect species.
I understand that the concept originated in Japan, I think, and some of these are designed so that there can be a pathway through them, so you can walk through and experience this dense forest. It's a pretty fascinating idea, and it would seem that it would really work in a lot of urban areas.
It would, but as long as you're talking about paths with trees. Urban Forest Initiative over the past year has focused on creating tree trails in communities that lack infrastructure, like sidewalks, like gymnasiums, exercise facilities. And what we have done is found interesting kind of paths that incorporate various interesting tree species along the way. And we have a whole library of tree signage that talks about the unique properties associated with particular species of trees. We have a library available where individuals can download information. But we built in Wayland, Kentucky, which is in Floyd County. Wayland is a little tiny former coal camp that houses about 350 people. There is a new high ground residential development that grew there, relocating flood victims from 2022. Mm-hmm. The homes that were built were fairly modest, without a lot of vegetation, you know, using sites that were kind of what's left over in eastern Kentucky. So Urban Forest Initiative, we planted trees at each of those Wayland high ground home sites and also saw opportunity to create a tree trail. Wayland is this little tiny town, again, lacking in, you know, there are no streetlights, there are no sidewalks, the road right-of-way does not have gutters, and there's really no place for people to experience nature outside of their homes other than their backyard. So we went there and found basically a 0.6-mile loop, if you will, that included 13 really unique and interesting species. We put up signage to indicate where those trees were located and also painted on the street how many steps individuals would get in moving through this tree trail.
So if people are listening to us and they really want to get involved with Tree Week, how can they find out more?
Go to the Urban Forest Initiative's website. We have our own tab for Tree Week, and we also have a drop-down tab for Get Involved. We have several activities that are in the pipeline where individuals can come together and just help hug a tree and show some love to the long-term residents of our community that maybe have not had a voice.
All right, this is Lynn Roach Phillips, co-director of the Urban Forest Initiative's Tree Week. It's happening through October 19th. Thank you so much, Lynn.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our contributors and their interviews. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Have a question about something you would like for us to look into? Record it on your phone and email us an MP3 to es@eku.edu with your name and town. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.